I could go ahead and start it now with this session. It's 8:45, and I want to leave as much time as possible for questions, as well as allow our presenter, Don Bradley, to give his paper. I guess I'm supposed to announce that this is session. The title they gave is crazy, but the session is entitled session 314, Davy, Fanny, Alger. Yeah, so you can put whatever meeting you want on that. I did come up with a title. I guarantee
you.
I'm not. Well, okay, Don. I'm not surprised. I mean, Don is always a bundle of surprises. He's been one of the most exciting, at times exasperating people to work with. I say that both as a friend and in honesty, because the reason I pass out that flyer is to give you an indication of the future of what he's going to present today. And I volunteered to chair this session. My name is Newell Bringhurst. I'm a retired professor of history and government at College of Sequoias in California. Happily retired. I've been retired for 4 years. And it's my great pleasure to have Don Bradley as a part of this panel. And what I passed out was a flyer, which his presentation today will be going into, or a good portion will be going into, our Persistence of Polygamy volume one, of which will be out in September. It's actually going to be its debut. I'm going to put a plug in here for the John Whitmer Historical Association. We've got a number of people in this room who are members of the John Whitmer Historical Association. It's going to be in Amboy, Illinois, actually Rockford, which is near Amboy. And the occasion for our meeting this year is the sesquicentennial, 150th anniversary of the founding of the RLDS, Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ, now known as the Community of Christ. And I've been a longtime member and admirer and fellow traveler with both the Community of Christ and John Whitmer. I've been a member of John Whitmer since 1977. So I invite you to come out to that conference. Enough of my commercial announcement, but I want to get to our presentation today. And Don Bradley, I mean, he's also somewhat of a modest guy too. He's kind of understated. He hardly gave me anything to sing his virtues about. He's a first-rate scholar. He's presently a MA candidate in history. That's history. I thought it was religious studies. Is it history that you're doing your work in? At Utah State University, he's also doing work in the religious studies department and in Mormon studies in particular under Phil Bartle, who you might remember from the first night he chaired the plenary session, and he's Leonard J. Arrington, has the Leonard J. Arrington Chair of History. And Don, I'll say up front, is one of his brightest graduate students. He's published a number of essays. He didn't put them down here, but I got to know Don Bradley initially when I guess it was back in the early part of the, right around the turn of the century. And then he published a brilliant essay on Joseph Smith. I think it was Sunstone, and that's when I really got to know him. And then we were involved in a session assessing Joseph Smith's biography. I guess that was about 5 years ago, a very memorable session. And so Don and I have a long-standing acquaintanceship. And he, as I say, he has done some fantastic work on Fanny Alger. He's uncovered more information and more insights into the complex, complicated relationship between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger. I might disagree a bit on some of his conclusions, but he makes a very, very persuasive case. And I guess the question that I want to throw out, that you might be thinking about as Don gives his paper, was the relationship between Fanny Alger and Joseph Smith, which has been well documented, was it was it merely a dirty, nasty little affair, as Oliver Cowdery described it, or was it indeed Joseph Smith's first plural marriage? And so I hope that you think about that. Maybe during the question and answer period, we can have a good, lively discussion on that central, fundamental question. So I'll give you over to Don Bradley.
Thank you, Noel. I have apparently nearly been responsible for Noel's demise. He tells me that I nearly caused him a heart attack by worrying him that I wouldn't get my chapter for the bookend on time. Fanny Alger was, by all accounts, and I'm paraphrasing just a bit here, hot. But if any of you reading this paper's title, Dating Fanny Alger, have come for tips on asking her out, you may want to first consider that this September 30th will mark her 193rd birthday. If, on the other hand, any of you guys, and I was going to say single guys, but that restriction may not apply here, are pursuing a younger and slightly more alive Fanny Alger, I would invite you to read the subtitle of my paper, Exit Immediately, and head to the nearest Deseret Book for LDS dating books and a copy of Singles Ward. Now to the slightly older Fanny Alger. In the middle of an Ohio night, Emma Hale Smith awoke in her bedroom to find her husband not there. Continuing her search, she found him missing from the house altogether, but not missing alone. The Smith's longtime house guest, Fanny Alger, an attractive and amiable girl in her late teens, was also missing. Following the light uncharacteristically shining in the barn, and then peering through a crack in the door, Emma located the pair together atop a hayloft, playing a game of Parcheesi or Chinese checkers, one presumes. If so, these must have been games of which Mrs. Smith deeply disapproved. While it was still dark, she unceremoniously decanted Fanny from the Smith homestead. And I imagine that Fanny got no more sleep that night than I did last night. Joseph swiftly dispatched someone, perhaps Fanny herself, to fetch Oliver Cowdery so he could calm Emma and begin the long process of setting the Smith house back in order. The assistant president had his work cut out for him. What the night's drama confirmed, Emma had likely suspected, as the lump on Fanny's belly had grown week by week. Where the scandalously pregnant girl stayed immediately after her unwilling departure from the Smith home, no one knows, but it was soon arranged that she would be parked at the home of the young Kirtland wagon maker Chauncey Webb and his wife Eliza Jane Churchill Webb. Fanny stayed with the Webbs for a few weeks until she could join up with family and headed west with them toward Missouri. The family stopped at the way station of Dublin, Indiana, and then moved on, but Fanny would never reach Zion. In November, she married non-Mormon Solomon Custer and disappeared from the Society of the Saints. This narrative of the discovery of Joseph Smith's relationship with Fanny Alger comes to us from the Webbs themselves, and secondhand from Emma, as her account was related through Kirtland-era apostle William McClellan. But the story raises more questions than it answers. Aside from the relationship between Joseph and Fanny Alger being intimate and involving the playing of board games, what was its nature? Was their coupling polygamous or adulterous? When was it discovered? On what basis was Fanny sent to stay those weeks in the Webb home rather than some other, like that of her parents, just 30 miles away? How did the scandal of the prophet and the girl unfold from there in Kirtland and the church? Only limited attempts have been made to answer more than the first of these questions, and the attempts, I would argue, have largely failed. The Kirtland explosion, or as one source understates it, the fuss over Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger has been misstated. This is unfortunate. Accurately answering the question of when Emma Smith discovered Joseph and Fanny puts the relationship in a context in which the questions of its nature and fallout can be better addressed. Once we properly situate the Fanny Alger blow-up in the timescape, we can watch the dominoes fall afterward. Dominoes, Chinese checkers, you know, it's all the same. The timing of this incident also has implications for what's probably the most important question for the present generation of Latter-day Saints. Was Fanny Alger old enough to date? The beginnings of the relationship between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger are cloudy, although there is one source that purports to narrate how Smith approached Alger for a plural marriage and pinpoint a time for the marriage. This late source has fully persuaded few major scholars, and the relationship's beginnings remain an open question. The sole detailed account of when and how the relationship began comes from Fanny Alger's cousin, Mosiah Hancock. Hancock, who was a toddler at the time the relationship was discovered, and not yet conceived at the time his report says it started, wrote his account in 1896 as an addendum to the autobiography of his father, Levi. Although Levi Hancock had written about his own life at the time in question, he had omitted any direct reference to Joseph Smith's relationship with his niece Fanny, daughter to his sister Clarissa Hancock Alger. Mosiah, believing he had accurate information to fill this lacuna, did so. I won't attempt a full discussion of that account today, but I'll point out its most glaring weaknesses. The author could have known the events only indirectly and recorded them 63 years after the fact. The account is also anachronistic to the Mormonism of 1833 when it says the marriage occurred. It assumes an established polygamous culture in which an unrelated girl living in a married man's house might be expected to become his wife and in which parents would readily agree to such a marriage. And the account places Joseph Smith's marriage to Fanny Alger under Emma's nose for at least 2.5 years before its discovery, and contradicts earlier information attributed to Mosiah's aunt Clarissa, Fanny Alger's mother. Clarissa Hancock Alger, according to an 1876 letter from Eliza Jane Churchill Webb, with whom Fanny had stayed when she left the Smith home, to Mary Bond, says, the mother, Fanny's mother, says Fanny was sealed to Joseph in Kirtland in 1835 or 6. To the extent that Eliza Webb's letter is accepted as reflecting the mother's understanding, Mosiah's account must be questioned. Given the lateness and difficulties of Hancock's narrative of the origin of the Smith-Alger pairing, it is unfortunate that it is the only one available. But if the beginning of the relationship eludes us, its ending can be more definitively pegged. Sources on Emma's discovery of Joseph and Fanny and her eviction of the girl are less detailed, but more abundant, closer to the event, and more trustworthy. A few scholars who have attempted to date the relationship's discovery have usually placed it around summer or fall 1835 on the basis of 4 evidentiary dots connected by Richard Van Wagner. First, Benjamin F. Johnson, writing at the turn of the 20th century, recalled hearing in 1835, when he was a youth of about Fanny's age, that biblical polygamy was to be restored, and hearing it, quote, whispered of Fanny that Joseph loved her. Second, it is evident from the article on marriage published in the Doctrine and Covenants in August 1835 that an embarrassing polygamy incident had occurred before that time. The article reads in part, "Inasmuch as this church has been reproached with the crime of fornication and polygamy, we declare that we believe that one man should have one wife and one woman but one husband, except in case of death, when either is at liberty to marry again." Third, Joseph Smith left Kirtland for Pontiac, Michigan, shortly before the special conference that voted on the article, and returned not long after, possibly suggesting that the article was passed in his absence to minimize embarrassment or avoid his opposition. And fourth, Joseph's diary for October 17th, 1835, alludes to his dealing with household issues, including evicting non-family residents. Quote, called my family together, arranged my domestic concerns, and dismissed my boarders. These fragments fit together neatly, but an 1835 dating of the incident is hardly above criticism. Johnson's recollection, written 68 years after the fact, is likely not precise on the timing of the rumors. And Smith's reference to dismissing his boarders, though referring to multiple persons, is completely ambiguous on their identity and why they were required to leave. Mark Ashurst McGee, who was a journals editor for the Joseph Smith Papers and a good friend of mine, has suggested to me that the boarders evicted from the Smith home were employees at the nearby printing office, where Smith had reported attempting to settle some difficulties the previous day. This fits perfectly with the autobiographical account given by one of the printers, Ebenezer Robinson, where he wrote, in May 1835, went to Kirtland, Ohio, and obtained a situation in the church printing office. The firm consisted of Joseph Smith, Frederick T. Williams, and Oliver Cowdery. We engaged to work by the month and be boarded by our employers. We boarded the first 2 months in the family of Oliver Cowdery, the second 2 months in the family of Frederick T. Williams, and the third 2 months in the family of Joseph Smith, Jr. Robinson's account yields a timetable something like this for the printer's mid-1835 boarding arrangements. In May and June, they stayed in the Oliver Cowdery household. In July and August, the Frederick T. Williams household. And in September-October, the Joseph Smith household. Robinson's narrative places the printing employees in the Smith home as boarders during October and likely leaving the home that month, making it more than probable that they were, in fact, the boarders evicted after the October 16th difficulties at the printer's office. Also problematic for Van Wagner's case for a summer-fall 1835 discovery of the Fanny-Alger relationship is that Joseph Smith does not appear to have gone to Pontiac to avoid a pre-planned vote on the article on marriage. Brian Hales, the author of the forthcoming volume on Joseph Smith's polygamy and a good friend who's here, has made the most extensive examination of the article on marriage to date. In his recent Journal of Mormon History piece, Fanny Alger and Joseph Smith's Pre-Nauvoo Reputation, Brian demonstrates that Smith's trip to Pontiac at the time the article was passed appears to have been for family and ecclesiastical reasons, and that the article had to be hastily drawn up and voted on in his absence because the Doctrine and Covenants was about to go to press. Each piece of evidence adduced for a summer-fall 1835 discovery for the Joseph Smith-Fanny Alger relationship thus has another, better explanation, rendering the ostensible case for that timing entirely moot. In addition to its being supported by no positive evidence, the typical dating for the Alger blow-up has evidence against it. Although discovering her husband with Fanny Alger is said to have turned Emma quite cross with him, there is one telling indication that Joseph and Emma were not seriously estranged between the August article on marriage and the October eviction of Joseph Smith's boarders. On June 20th of the following year, Joseph and Emma had their son Frederick, whose conception likely occurred in September between the article and the eviction. So when did Emma's discovery of Joseph and Fanny on the hayloft occur? Though no known sources directly say, the evidence they provide, if methodically pieced together, allows us to zero in on a precise timing for the event. Fanny Alger left the Kirtland area in late August 1836 with her uncle, Levi Hancock, whom we will soon discuss more, and with her parents in early September, establishing that as the latest when the discovery could have occurred. But Joseph Smith had left Kirtland still earlier, on the evening of July 25th, and returned only after Fanny was gone, moving the incident at the barn to no later than the night of July 24th. Can we establish a lower boundary on when this incident occurred? Indeed, we can. In a little-known letter to another old resident of Mormon Kirtland, Eliza Jane Webb reported that Fanny's mother maintained that Joseph and Fanny were sealed in 1835 or 1836. The mother's dating of the relationship's beginning to 1835 or 36 weighs against an 1835 discovery of the relationship and in favor of an 1836 discovery. If Clarissa Alger believed the marriage might not have begun until 1836, she could not have understood it to be discovered and terminated prior to that. Other sources allow us to home in more precisely on the 1836 incident. Oliver Cowdery would complain in 1837 and 1838 that Joseph and Fanny had carried on what Newell mentioned, a dirty, nasty, filthy relationship, or he uses the word affair. But such complaints are significant by their absence in early spring 1836, when Oliver had no apparent trouble accepting Joseph's purity and worthiness to dedicate the Kirtland Temple on March 27th and to see Christ and receive priesthood keys on April 3rd. Whenever Oliver was called in to make peace in the Smith household, it was likely after April 3rd. Additional testimony from one of the residents of the Smith household at the time of the blow-up confirms this spring-summer 1836 date. This testimony was collected by 19th century LDS historian Andrew Jensen. Jensen was the first Latter-day Saint to publish Fanny Alger's name as that of one of Joseph Smith's plural wives, and the rest of us have followed in his footsteps. What has not been known is why Jensen included her on his list, on what authority he made the identification. Newly available documents at the LDS History Library demonstrate why. In 1886, Jensen interviewed several of the prophet's wives and others about his polygamy and left his research notes in a hitherto unused folder in his research collection. I've carefully examined these documents for what they reveal. I must admit, though, that I didn't find them without help. I found them by following the still small voice of Robin Jensen of the Joseph Smith Papers. So many thanks to him. I don't think he's here. I have good friends for this kind of research. Analyzing the papers In analyzing the papers, I have found that the name Fanny Alger appears on his list of the prophet's wives, but not in Jensen's own handwriting. Rather, after making careful comparisons, I've identified the writer of Fanny's name as none other than Eliza R. Snow, president of the Relief Society, and herself one of the prophet's plural widows. And this judgment has been confirmed. Eliza's biographer, Jill Durr, came and looked at the document with Brian Hales and I, and she said that basically short of a professional handwriting analysis, she gave her, strongest judgment that there was every indication that it was Eliza's handwriting. And I've got, if I had the technology available here, I would show you, and if you want to see the document, I can show you after on my laptop. At Jensen's request, Eliza R. Snow recorded for him a handwritten list of her sister wives, including Fanny Alger. She was his source on Alger. When Jensen subsequently interviewed Eliza about Fanny's life and relationship with Joseph Smith, she told him, according to his notes, that Fanny was, quote, one of the first wives Joseph married, and one whom, quote, Emma made such a fuss about. Most significantly, Eliza explained how she knew about Fanny Alger and the relationship. Quote, these are Jensen's notes, some of his notes from the conversation. Sister E.R. Snow was well acquainted with her as she lived with the prophet at the time, meaning the time of Emma's fuss on discovering the pair together. Snow's presence in the house at the time of the discovery narrows the range for when it could have occurred. According to her autobiography, Eliza R. Snow lived in the Smith's Kirtland home twice, once in mid-1836 while teaching a spring or spring-summer school term, and again at the first of 1837. Since by 1837 Fanny Alger was in Indiana, it could only have been during the first of these two stays, in mid-1836, that Snow and Alger shared the house and the great fuss occurred. The testimony of a contemporary member of the household that the relationship was discovered during her 1836 residence confirms that a relationship occurred and nails down the approximate time of its discovery and consequent termination. Eliza Webb's 1876 letter to Mary Bond reported, quote, "Fanny Alger had lived in Joseph's family several years. When she left there, she came and lived with me a few weeks. Fanny left with family, reportedly around the end of August or in the first half of September. The few weeks that Fanny stayed with the Webbs very likely constituted less than 2 months, where it would have been more sensible for Eliza Webb to gauge the time in months rather than weeks. We can thus put Fanny's placement with the Webbs probably no earlier than late June, and given the ordinary connotations of the phrase a few weeks, probably somewhere in July. Finally, additional clues from the account of her uncle Levi Hancock also indicate that the blow-up over Fanny Alger occurred in that month. Hancock's autobiography describes a series of June-July 1836 events surrounding one event that specifically involved Joseph Smith and Hancock's niece, Fanny. Wrote Levi Hancock, "I worked at my trade through the summer, nearly, when I heard that the people of Clay County were about to drive our brethren from that county. It was about that time I received a letter from my brother Solomon. He said he had taken another wife," this isn't polygamy yet, his first wife had died, "and was going to Missouri. I saw Joseph Smith, and he told me to take Fanny Alger. I offered my place and sold it before night, made me a wagon, got it ironed, rimmed some wheels for Solomon, and we started the latter part of August for his father-in-law's and got there the 1st of September, 1836. We stayed there about 1 week more and started for Missouri." Levi Hancock's account reports that his brother Solomon was moving to Missouri and that the prophet instructed Levi to go to Missouri as well and take Fanny Alger with him. Levi Hancock's account also provides several datable events surrounding this instruction. First, Levi says the people of Clay County were building momentum to drive the saints out of the county, mob action that finally erupted on June 28, 1836. Second, he reports that his brother Solomon, who had been serving a mission, wrote to him to tell him he had remarried, describing nuptials that occurred at Canaan, Ohio, about 90 miles southwest of Kirtland, on that same day, June 28th. Solomon's letter probably reached his brother around the 1st of July. Next in the sequence, Levi places the prophet's instructions to emigrate with Fanny Alger, followed by his efforts to prepare for the trip, then his late August journey to Canaan, where Solomon's in-laws lived, and finally his week stay in Canaan in early September. Joseph Smith thus instructed Levi Hancock, quote, to take Fanny Alger to Missouri in July 1836, prior to his own departure on the evening of the 25th, and Hancock left for Missouri, presumably with Fanny Alger, about a month later. Fanny Alger was thus placed in the Webb home around the middle of July 1836. With the precise time frame in place, the next part of our exploration can begin. Tracing Kirtland's Fanny Alger scandal as it unfolded. At the center of the scandal are first, the discovery of Joseph and Fanny in physical intimacy by Emma, and second, Fanny's pregnancy. The reports that Fanny was pregnant at the time Emma evicted her aren't widely known and are still less widely believed, but they should be. Those who report the pregnancy are the people with whom she stayed after the eviction, the Webbs, and they were in a position to know. In Utah, Chauncey Webb told journalist Wilhelm Weil that Emma, quote, "drove the girl, who was unable to conceal the consequences of her celestial relation with the prophet, out of her house." In spite of his facetious wording, Chauncey Webb was in an excellent position to know the truth of the matter. At minimum, Webb's statement means that Fanny appeared visibly pregnant, at the time she arrived at his home, and that his observations of her over the next 4 or 5 weeks were consistent with an increasing appearance of pregnancy. Webb was also in a position to hear explanations from Fanny and those who placed her in his house. It's strange credulity to think that Fanny was brought to the Webb home in the midst of scandal with no explanation. And in fact, Chauncey's wife Eliza reported that Fanny herself offered sufficient explanation. Quote, "I did not know that the sealing commenced in Kirtland, but I am perfectly satisfied that something similar commenced. My judgment is principally formed from what Fanny Alder told me herself concerning her reasons for leaving Sister Emma." Another reason to think the women would have communicated openly on the topic of whether Fanny was pregnant is that if she was pregnant during her stay with the Webbs, she was not alone in this condition. At the time Fanny took refuge in Eliza Webb's home, her benefactor was a good 4 months pregnant with her own first child, Chauncey Jr. The pregnancy was no doubt a factor in Emma's rage at the guest she had found intimate with her husband. No sooner had Emma given birth to her son Frederick on June 20th than she discovered that Fanny, too, had been given the privileges of wife and mother. Oliver Cowdery, who mediated the marital rift caused by this discovery, may have allowed Fanny to stay with his family the remainder of that night and perhaps for the few succeeding days. We don't know. But another incident would soon spread the scandal far and wide within Kirtland and lead her to the Webb home and ultimately out of the state. Benjamin Winchester, later a plural brother-in-law of Joseph's and a church leader in Philadelphia and ultimately an apostate, stated that, quote, "In the summer of 1836, in response to, quote, a good deal of scandal prevalent among a number of the saints concerning Joseph's licentious conduct, he came out and made a statement in the temple before a general congregation that he was authorized by God Almighty to establish his kingdom, that he was God's prophet and God's agent, and that he could do whatever he should choose to do. Therefore, the church had no right to call into question anything he did or to censure him, for the reason that he was responsible to God Almighty only. This promulgation created a great sensation. A schism occurred, and a large portion of the first membership, including the best talent of the church, at once withdrew from it. The cause of this confrontation in the temple may be further illuminated by a source I discovered while working with Brian Hales for nearly 2 years studying Joseph Smith's polygamy. Unfortunately, I have not been able to locate the source in my files within the last few weeks, nor to recall the name of its author. So its full explanation must await a published version of this paper. The gist, however, is this. Joseph was accused in a church meeting of having had an improper relationship with the girl who was then in the congregation, but denied having done so. Another echo of this most unusual occasion of temple worship is contained in the addendum to Levi Hancock's autobiography written by his son Mosiah. The events narrated would have occurred when Mosiah was only a toddler, and they are told in what must be overstatement. But they dovetail with the other accounts of a conflict in the Kirtland Temple over Joseph Smith's relationship with the girl, and with Joseph Smith's instruction. It also dovetails with Joseph Smith's instruction to Levi to remove Fanny from Kirtland. Mosiah's account reads, "As time progressed, the apostates thought they had a good hold on Joseph because of Fanny, and some of the smart," and he puts a question mark after it, "some of the smart ones confined her in an upper room of the temple, determined that the prophet should be settled according to their notions. Brother Joseph came to Father and said, 'Brother Levi, what can be done?' There being a wagon and a dry goods box close by, and Joseph being strong and Father active, Father soon gained the window sill, and Fanny was soon on the ground. Father mounts his horse with Fanny behind him, and although dark, they were in New Lyme, 45 miles distant. And when the worthies sent Fanny's dinner the next day, they were astonished not to be able to find her." Mosiah narrates that those who knew by rumor of Fanny's relationship with Joseph attempted in the temple to expose that relationship, whereon Joseph instructed Levi Hancock to spirit her away. The Kirtland Temple is too tall for Fanny Alger to have likely been rescued in this way, and Mosiah's account contradicts his father's, in which Levi is not to take his niece away to his family in nearby New Lyme, Ohio, but to Missouri. But given that the Mosiah Hancock account correctly describes a conflict over Fanny centered on the temple and the need for Levi to steal her away from Joseph's accusers, it likely also correctly describes the relationship between these two events. And this relationship is a natural one. Public accusations in the temple and an attempt to get the guilty pair to confess prompted Joseph to have Fanny taken away from Kirtland. And Fanny was not the only one to leave town. I've mentioned earlier that Joseph left Kirtland for several weeks, beginning in late July, but I have not mentioned the circumstances under which he left. Joseph left town on Monday, July 25th, the day after Sabbath services would have been held in the Kirtland Temple, almost certainly the same services in which the dissenters condemned him and Fanny Alger, and in which his defense of his actions only drew out further dissent. I have also not indicated where Joseph went when he left Kirtland that following day. He went to Salem. For several decades, historians have tried to make sense of the senseless, of why Joseph Smith left Kirtland at the drop of a hat on a rumor of buried treasure in a basement of someone's old house on the other side of the country in this old Massachusetts seaboard town. Where is the precedent for such behavior? Certainly Joseph was known to lead digs for treasure in his adolescence, but not as a prophet. Nor was he known to make sudden jags from the Midwest to the Atlantic for little reason. But when Joseph Smith's Salem treasure trip is placed in the context of growing scandal over his relationship with Fanny Alger, the picture changes. Never mind that traveling cross-country on rumors of buried treasure is not a good investment strategy. For Joseph Smith, he was then confronting angry church members bent on exposing his secret relationship with Fanny Alger. No pretext for getting out of town was too small. And the farther and longer the journey, the better. In the wake of the temple confrontation, Joseph instructed Levi Hancock to, quote, take Fanny Alger and go west to Missouri, while he went east to Salem. This elegant solution not only put both Joseph and Fanny away from those who were so zealous to help them begin their, quote, repentance process with public confession, it also placed them far apart from each other to undermine rumors that they were together as a couple. The prophet's desire to get Fanny out west while he went east also explains her stay with the Webb family. The Webbs had no evident social ties with the Algers, but they had geographical connections to the Hancocks. Mosiah Hancock, describing his very early childhood in Kirtland, reports that next to the Hancock home stood a wagon factory at which there worked such an oddly named man, Pardon. This memory places the Hancocks beside the prominent Kirtland wagon makers, Pardon and Chauncey Webb. The Hancocks were family to Fanny and were to take her with them to Zion, and they were on the outskirts of Kirtland, a perfect place to send Fanny to keep her from the public eye, assuming they had room in their house for this refugee. If not, the ideal place for Fanny to wait while Levi Hancock prepared for his journey by fixing his wagon wheels, no doubt at the Webb wagon manufactory, was a more spacious home as close to Levi as possible, like that of the successful next-door neighbors, the Webbs. While getting out of Kirtland may have been a wise strategy for letting the Alger blow-up blow over, its fallout did not end with Joseph's trip east. One sec.
Is there maybe a stretch, I guess. But let's see. That like a suspect. Is that producing an hour? Because it's kind of
yeah.
It
looks
yeah. Is it working okay?
It is. Yeah. Good. He would have to return to the same situation at home. The context of Joseph's journey explains the reassurance he gave to Emma by letter on August 19th. Joseph wrote of Salem and his expectation of being home in a month, but closed the letter more poignantly, quote, "I want that you should believe me that I am your sincere friend and husband." Emma, though never reconciling to anything other than the monogamous marriage she had been taught to expect, did reconcile with Joseph after his return. Others never did. That same month, Apostle William McClellan left the 12 and the church. McClellan was a physician and a man of such noted intellect that he had been selected 5 years earlier as, quote, "the most wise man in the church" to compose a revelation that could compete with one of Joseph's. McClellan's reason for leaving the 12, given in his letter to the other 11 apostles, was that he, quote, "no longer had confidence in the heads of the church," no doubt referring to the heads over the 12, the first presidency, and primarily to the head of the church, the absented prophet. In the context of the rumors of Joseph and Fanny and the July 24th conflict at the temple, the reason for McClellan's resignation seems clear, and it is clearly described by Benjamin Winchester. McClellan, more than anyone, fit Winchester's account that Joseph's defense of himself in the temple as above earthly criticism prompted the apostasy of, quote, "the best talent of the church," who immediately withdrew from it. The Fanny Alger scandal led to rumors both of the prophet engaging in adultery and of the prophet engaging in polygamy. John Whitmer, the official church historian at the time, wrote later of the time just after Joseph's return from Salem, quote, "In the fall of 1836, Joseph, Sidney Rigdon, and other leaders of the church were lifted up in pride and lusted after the forbidden things such as the spiritual wife doctrine, that is, plurality of wives. The consequences for the plural wife herself also continued. The Hancocks left for Missouri at the end of August. The Alger parents reportedly left from their nearby home in September, apparently deciding that if their daughter, an unborn child by the prophet, were headed for Missouri, they would go and receive their inheritances in Zion with their offspring. Fanny may have waited for them at the Webbs, even after her uncle Levi left, or perhaps more likely, she may have traveled with Levi to her uncle Solomon's new wife and in-laws in Canaan, or gone on with these family members to Dublin. In either case, she likely awaited the parents in one of these locations. But Fanny's long layover in Dublin was to become permanent when she married Solomon Custer. Why did she marry so quickly? She could not have been in Indiana more than 6 weeks before tying the knot with Solomon Custer, a move that has led one present-day historian, Janet Ellingson, to argue that Fanny had never seen herself as married to Joseph Smith. I believe a better answer is provided by Fanny's pregnancy and her desire to give her unborn child a life free from the stigma of illegitimacy and to spare herself the stigma of giving birth to an illegitimate child. The disaster in Kirtland had made clear that she could not continue her relationship with the prophet, and he had sent her away like Abraham sending away Hagar. What mattered to her now was her relationship with her child and how she could protect him or her. What then became of the child Fanny sought to protect? Eliza Webb wrote of Fanny Alger, "I only know that Emma turned Fanny out of her house because of Joseph's intimacy with her. Joseph never had any living children by his polygamous women, although it is always supposed that Eliza R. Snow had a child. Fanny Alger had lived in Joseph's family for several years," etc., etc. Eliza Webb implies an awareness that Fanny was pregnant by Joseph, splicing her statement about Joseph's children through polygamy into the middle of a discussion of Fanny Alger. But she avers that none of these children, of whom she knew, lived, implying the fate of Fanny Alger's child. Either there was not a live birth, or the child died young. Memory of the relationship lived on. Rumors of it peaked in 1837 when Oliver Cowdery was most actively discussing it, gossip that contributed to his excommunication months later. Also in 1837, likely in response to these rumors, Joseph published a list of frequently asked questions about the Mormons in the Elders' Journal, including, do the Mormons believe in having more wives than one? Yet, as noted earlier, the rumors were of two types, rumors of polygamy and rumors of adultery, an interpretive divide that continues to this day and likely into this room. What, if anything, does the dating of the Fanny Alger, what, if anything, does the dating of the Kirtland scandal over Fanny Alger tell us on this question of whether she was a mistress or a wife? While the timing of the discovery cannot in itself settle such a question, it does bear implications for it. A July 1836 end date for the relationship of Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger who was visibly pregnant with his child allows for a plausible beginning date to the relationship of any time up to, this is my construction of it here, based on the assumption that she would start, her pregnancy would really start showing at maybe about 3 months. Allows for a plausible beginning date to the relationship of any time up to and including April 1836. This is significant for three reasons. First, it means that the relationship plausibly and even likely began after the August 1835 article on marriage. Just lost my place. Responding to an incident of LDS polygamy. That incident was not Joseph Smith's relationship with Fanny Alger, raising the question of just what it was, but the article shows that polygamy in some form had arisen within the church sometime before Joseph and Fanny are known to have been involved, mooting the common argument that their relationship was too early to have been polygamous. Second, it plausibly places the relationship's beginning after Joseph Smith began publicly performing marriage ceremonies in November 1835, raising the chances that this relationship could have been inaugurated with the marriage ceremony. And finally, it places the relationship's beginning possibly after the coming of Elijah to the Kirtland Temple on April 3rd, 1836, to bring keys under which marriage sealings were done in Nauvoo and are done in the LDS Church today. For the relationship to have begun under that authority, marriage would have been needed almost immediately after the Elijah event. This is reasonably possible, if not necessarily probable, allowing for the possibility of their relationship having been a marriage sealing in the familiar sense. Lining up once again in historical reconstruction, the dominoes of 1836 Kirtland, placing the Fanny Alger incident in its proper order among them and tipping it, plays out before us an unfamiliar story. The story is by turns wrenching, as when Emma discovers Joseph intimate with a pregnant Fanny just a month after she has given birth to Frederick. Poignant, when Joseph hopes his wounded wife can accept that he is her sincere friend and husband. Amusing, when Joseph supposedly runs away after buried treasure, when the opportunity to run away is the treasure he seeks. And, for better or for worse, biblical, when Joseph becomes a beleaguered Abraham and Fanny the relinquished Hagar. The story's consequences have been far-reaching. Oliver Cowdery, estranged partly over Fanny Alger, would have likely led the church after Joseph Smith were it not for that estrangement. Polygamy, apparently inaugurated with Fanny Alger, shaped 19th century Mormonism in ways that continue to inform its character today. Joseph Smith's relationship with Fanny Alger is employed endlessly in apologetic critical debate over Mormonism's truth, and even the Salem treasure incident occasionally rears its odd little head. The chain reaction set in motion by Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger in 1836 did not soon stop, and perhaps never will. Thank you.
Don continues to revise and update this paper. He's got things in here. I think it was in the last version that you've given me. So, as I say, Don is always a bundle of surprises. I don't know. what the final form will be. I assume this is pretty close to the final form that is going to appear in our anthology, but I'm sure you will agree that he has done, it's an absolutely outstanding contribution. I think it will, set the tone for just the whole reassessing of the beginnings of polygamy during the 1830s. We have about 10 minutes for questions. I'm sure there must be some questions out there, so would you please come forward and Donna will do the best to answer your questions.
I would suggest that most women don't show up 3 months,
okay.
Maybe four, so that might change the Elijah.
Yeah. Yes.
But I have another question. She was visibly pregnant at the time Emma discovered them. Would not Emma and everyone else been aware of that before they were discovered, the day before, whatever? Would there have been questions about why is she here with this large? Would that have caused some concern right then?
Yeah. I think there are multiple accounts that say that Emma discovered Joseph and Fanny together. That was what precipitated Fanny being evicted. There is also the indication from the Webbs, with whom she stayed right afterward, that she was pregnant. And Chauncey Webb says basically says she was visibly pregnant. So what I would imagine is that Emma could see that it looked like Fanny might be pregnant and maybe had suspected some things and then actually found that she was right.
In thinking about writings of previous authors, I'm thinking of George D. Smith and Richard Van Wagner and Brian Hales. Would you say that your contribution now has been more one of looking at all of the different people that were involved with Fanny Alger one way or another and looking at the time frames, their movements here and there? Would you say that that's your biggest contribution to researching this question?
So I have given Newell a surprise, because this is actually a different essay than the one for the volume, but it has some overlapping content that will be different in when this one's published, but that for the purposes of writing this paper, I just pulled from that chapter. The stuff on the 1835, criticizing the 1835 dating. The chapter takes a look at all of the evidence that I could identify that the relationship was either adultery or that it was a marriage. That's mostly what the chapter goes over, a few things, but mostly that, and tries to weigh that out. This paper, tries to really look at how the events unfold, and that Van Wagner really had tried to take a look at that, but as I argued, I really think he got just the wrong time frame altogether. So this paper, makes, I guess, the contribution primarily showing how things play out.
In the controversy and the confrontation in the temple, my question is, was that the first hint of impropriety? Specifically, as early as 1832, Joseph had been living in the Johnson home in Hiram, and when he was drug out, they tried to force the poison, drug Sidney behind the horses. One of the accusations that was made there is inappropriate relationships between Joseph and Miranda Johnson, who later married Orson Hyde, divorced Orson Hyde in Utah, was still to Joseph, and had an affinity for Joseph, was one of Joseph's poor wives in Nauvoo. So my question is, in the Fanny Alger situation, was there hints of other relationships that predated Fanny?
So when it comes to Miranda Johnson in particular, that's controversial, and Brian Hales has actually written on that particular relationship or that particular claim. The early evidence suggests that the Johnson brothers were actually angry at Joseph over property issues and things like that. And then you've got a much later claim by Clark Braden that the issue was sexual. So that's not nailed down by anything close to the event. The article on marriage is evidence that something was going on related to polygamy before this Fanny Alger blow-up, but the article on marriage is not specific as to who the people were involved. And so unless or until we can find further evidence specifying that, it's not clear that that would be Joseph Smith or just someone in the church who just took it upon themselves to take a second wife or what.
Don, did any of your research raise the issue of Eliza Winter and the Martin Harris statement and so on? And could it be that the lingering rumors from that may have factored into the 1835 revelation, or excuse me,
the article on marriage,
but the document 1835. So little has been written on that. Do you ever find anything about that?
I have looked into that some. So Martin Harris claimed, someone in Harmony, one of Emma's cousins, claimed in a later affidavit that Martin Harris had said things justifying Joseph in, quote, attempting to seduce Eliza Winters, which is something that is apparently presumed to or supposed to have happened in like 28 or 29. If there were rumors of anything like that, I doubt that would be what would be driving the 1835 statement. I would think that would be fairly obscure, and it would have been before there really was a church, that time period. But I don't know. The statement that was made on that by Levi Lewis is very interesting, but I don't know for sure.
Couple questions. I've always heard William McClellan lost faith in the church more due to the Kirtland banking crisis. I'm just wondering how much do you think that played in his no confidence in the church leaders? I'm also wondering if there are any census records from 1840 on his childhood with Fanny and Solomon Custer.
Okay, yeah. So William McClellan, we don't have the 1836 letter that he wrote, but we have mention of it. I think he's excommunicated in like 38, and I think it's at his excommunication where it's mentioned that he had written this earlier letter in August 1836 saying he had no confidence in the heads of the church and was leaving. The banking scandal happens a few months after Joseph returns from Salem. He actually goes to New York on that same trip, and that financial things that he does there become the basis for the Kirtland Bank. So that's after McClellan, after his initial disaffection. I have tried to look at the later censuses to see if Fanny Alger and Solomon Custer are raising a child who was born around the right time, and I can't find a child around that age, and so I'm assuming, and it's possible someone else could have raised the child, but I'm really assuming that that what Eliza Webb implied was correct, that the child didn't live.
There was, around this time, an accusation against Oliver Cowdery for adultery, and I'm just wondering how that fits in with Fanny Alger. Was that before Joseph was discovered with Fanny Alger, or after? And then in relation to the article on marriage, and then my second question would be, with your timeline that you have, would Fanny Alger have married after she had given birth or while she was still pregnant?
Okay. I don't know exactly when the pregnancy began, but she couldn't have been, if she'd been showing too much in her pregnancy, then presumably Emma would have realized things more definitely sooner. And I don't know, based on what I've tried to put together, I think that the child would have been born, trying to remember now, I think around December. And the marriage occurred in November. And so I think that the rushed marriage was actually an attempt to give the child a legitimate birth. What was your other?
In regards to Oliver Cowdery.
Oh, Oliver Cowdery, yeah. There's nothing contemporaneous that indicates that about Oliver. And when he's tried in 1838 for his membership, basically everything that could be said bad about him is dug up and used as a charge. There are like 10 charges or something. There's nothing of that sort. I think there's probably some confusion there. Oliver, we do know that he was engaged in 1830, I think it was, to Elizabeth Whitmer, David Whitmer's sister. And then, apparently, while he was out on a mission, he got engaged to someone else. And so I suspect that might be the basis of the... He ended up breaking off the second engagement and marrying Elizabeth, but he was maybe not poorly married, but poorly engaged.
We got one more question. Yeah, just one more.
I had heard that Fanny Alger was interviewed or questioned about this and had some comment or lack of comment several years later. And also, how did she end up in relation to the church over the long term?
Okay, good questions. So Benjamin F. Johnson, who was around Fanny Alger's age, who appears to have had an excellent memory, he recounted what he recalled in a letter he wrote in 1902. So he said that at some point after all this, Fanny's brother John had asked her about the relationship, and she had said something to the effect of, "That is a matter all of my own, and I have nothing to relate." In the chapter that's going to be in this book that Mills talked about, I address that statement and other reports of what the family members and others had said. As far as her relationship with the church, she does end up becoming a universalist later in life, and apparently a spiritualist. I found an obituary that has not been used before. Apparently Todd Compton wasn't able to find an obituary. But I found an obituary that indicates that she was a spiritualist at the end of her life. And however, I think in 1842, so you never know who she was talking to, you know. In 1842, I think it was, there are church records that have her, in Illinois, that have her parents listed as members and have her listed as a member. It's not really clear why. There's no known indication other than that she lived anywhere other than Indiana at that point. So I don't know if she temporarily moved to Illinois and then moved back. I don't know if the parents just, for some reason, decided to list her in the membership records. That's a puzzle.
Well, thanks for Don's excellent presentation, and thanks for your audience questions and participation, and I thanks for coming out.